Because rap has always done well in Nigeria. Like, you're talking about a genre that's like M.I., Olamide, Ojemode, Files, Ladipo, 30, 40 strong alumni of like people that have done really great in the genre. And for some reason, we just don't get that recognition of being like, we are the, probably the strongest subculture in Nigeria.
Why do you feel like labels struggle to last in the Nigerian ecosystem?
Jude Abaga, AKA M.I., he's the voice that refined Nigerian hip hop. From his breakout track, Crowd Mentality, to his game-changing debut album, Talk About It, M.I. cemented his place as one of Africa's most influential rappers.
I used to say, right before I left Chocolate City, that I'm the most successful artist in Nigeria. I said that not because I had the most money, but because...
But M.I. is more than just a rapper. He's a visionary. As the founder and CEO of Task, he's building platforms that empower artists, expand creative opportunities, and drive social impact across Africa.
It's not simple what it means to be a man now. However, if you're not a man, society will discard you.
His influence extends far beyond music. M.I. Abaga is shaping the future of Africa's creative industry. So how has marriage changed you, not just as an artist, but as a man?
We all know M.I. Abaga, the rapper, the CEO, the hitmaker. But who is the man behind M.I.? When the cameras are off and the music stops, who is Jude Abaga?
Is that question number one?
Question
yes.
number one.
Oh, we're going right into it.
Right in. Okay. That's a good question. You know, I think the older you get, the more when someone asks you, who are you? Mm. Like, you actually like I'm a five-year-old boy that is awed by creativity. And it's awed by the world. Like, I really walk around the world and I'm like, whoa, that's so cool. Still to this day. Mm. And I love music. I love football. I love sports. I love community. I love friends. I love being Nigerian. I feel like the opportunity that we have because we were among the generation of children that were born on earth. They were given a very difficult puzzle. Mm. You know, a lot of people came and everything was sorted out, but we have an interesting puzzle to figure out in our time. And I enjoy that. And yeah, man, I'm a music maker sometimes. You already covered that part. So I make music sometimes. I'm working on this incredible project called Task that I really love. And yeah, I don't know what else. I'm a great dancer. Great dancer, by the way. You know, I'm trying to respect Nigeria and Nigerians for now. But yeah.
So I first want to go into your debut album. Yeah. Let's Talk About It, right? Mm. So it really changed the game for Nigerian rap.
Yeah.
But I want you right now to look at all your albums and rank them from best to worst.
Good question.
Like which albums excited you, but which albums question. You cringe when you now look back?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have... I think the tough part is going to be putting the ones at the bottom.
Okay.
Because every project reached a point where I was like, this is done, you know? But if I were to pick my top project, can I do a top five?
Yeah.
Okay, a top five. So my top project, excluding the one I just recorded that isn't out, but my top project so far would probably be Illegal Music 3, which was a mixtape. I would say the second is an album called Study on Self. It's about like exploring what goes on inside our hearts, inside our head. Number three, MI2, maybe my second project. Man, I know my fans are losing their minds right now. Number four, oh man, this is tough. I gotta put, I'll put the first one, Talk About It, and then I'll put Illegal Music 2. And I'm putting that, the second mixtape, because I know that fans of that mixtape will not let me hear word if I don't put it on my top five.
But which one do you want to put?
I would put, like, my personal favorite, I have an album called Judah. It's very little known. It's sort of very, like, melancholy. But I really like that, you know, because I feel I've gotten better as I've gotten older in terms of the storytelling and my ability to craft music. So I listen to it differently. For fans that got into me early, they're like, what? Nothing better than African rapper number one. But for me, like, you know, I can hear that I've improved in my later work. Yeah.
And which out of those albums, and maybe it's not your top five, but transformed you as a person? Like, as you went through the process, you became a different person on the other side.
Ooh, this is a great question, huh?
Hey, see question.
No, I love it. I would say, you know, I have an album called Study on Self. Mm-hmm. And that would have been the one. It's just that I think I was still a little bit young to really understand the context of mental health. You know, to really understand my new own neurodiversity, its impact on my life. I have a new album called The Wolf, right? And The Wolf is an acronym for, to humans everywhere, whatever occurs, look forward, right? And to me, this is the project where I was able to look at my life, 2 decades of being an adult, highs and lows, betrayal, disappointment, failure, success, growth, everything, and be able to be like, oh, here is a project that I feel people will be changed by listening to, and recording it changed me as well. It allowed me to see myself deeper. So The Wolf, which is 2025, maybe, fingers crossed. That's the one.
I love that. And I want to also talk about collaborations, because you know, the rap game is all about collaborating with the right people. You've had some legendary ones. Yeah. You've done Nas, right?
Yeah.
Wizkid, yeah. Nasty C, yeah. Brian Rowe. Honestly, the list could go on and on, all the people you've worked with. But which one were your top three favorites and why?
I think it all comes down to like the relationship between the artist and, you know. So African rapper number one, right? I met Flavor somewhere. We spoke about collaborating. It's actually a three-way collaboration because Ice Prince wrote the initial melody and the line, Africa rapper number one. And then he just sort of murmured the rest of the melody. Flavor walks in and he listens to the music and he's like, okay, can I have the studio for 30 minutes? And it's the easiest session I've ever had. I left, hung out a little bit, came back, chorus, bridge, done. Recorded with the parts, everything.
What?
And we just hung out the rest of the time. And Flavor is one of the best people to hang out with. So that'd be up there. There's so many, man. Of course, working with my brother, Jesse, I would just put him as a standalone, like up there. You know, he's, whether it's production or making music with him, you know, that's always really special. You mentioned like Nas and that category. I would say that Olamide, who's on that song as well, was one of my best experiences because at this time, it's actually really difficult to clear a verse and all that. And especially the level of an artist like Olamide, and you know, you got to go through management, their labels, etc., etc. And Olamide, literally, I sent him a message. He was like, okay, I'll do it. Then I said, it's a hook. He was like, oh, perfect. I thought it was going to be a verse. I was a little bit worried about doing a verse, but sent him the, I think he was just busy at the period. So he was like, send it to him. He sent it, the verse back to me 30 minutes later with everything I needed to clear it, you know, really easy. And people talk about Badu in that way, you know, but I'm one of those people, every time I can get a chance to speak, I'm just like, he truly is an artist that makes it easy for everybody to work around him. And I think that's why he's so revered by people that know and respect him.
I love that. Yeah. And, you know, I want you to talk about a song or a project that you wish you never released.
You guys didn't even need to do the questions.
And you're like, I wish I could bring it back.
I have one.
Okay.
I do have one.
Okay.
I have a song called The Chairman.
What?
Yes. What?
Yes.
Hold on. You got to break this down.
Yeah, I have a song called The Chairman. Now, let me tell you why. There are two reasons why I wish I hadn't put it out. So, reason number one is because the key of the song, this was the only song where I acquiesced to a label deadline. So the label was like, we gotta do this by March 1st, whatever. And I ended up doing it. And when I went to perform, I realized the song was in a key that was too low. So it made it impossible for me to perform the record. And that just ruined the experience for me. I knew in my heart, we rushed this. I knew that we didn't get it all the way there. I really love the song in its pieces, but the final version, I didn't really like. Great producer, E. Kelly, and you know. But the song now didn't end up being on the album called The Chairman, right? And the album The Chairman was about me arriving in Lagos like in 2007, 2008, and being like, this kid from Jos, being like, how is this gonna happen? And then I had this moment in 2013 where I walked into a meeting, you know, it was like all these chairmen. And when I walked in, everybody got up. I said, chairman. And I remember being like, whoa, like in this period of time, I've gone from literally being nobody to being in Lagos context to being called Chairman. That was the arc of the album. And the last song, Chairman, is like a gospel song where I'm like, I've gotten this far because of the real Chairman, God. And I felt like the single Chairman, it bent the arc of the album, right? So because the single came out first, people heard the name of the song. The story of what I was trying to do with Chairman sort of got lost in all that. And that's the one song where I don't regret making the song, you know, but I was like, we could have done it better. You know, we could have waited a little bit more, changed the key, you know, but it's so, people love the song. And, you know, again, don't be upset with me. She asked, you know, she's the one, it's her.
Instigating.
So speaking about rap, right? So you are OG, you've been in the game for a very long time now. So looking at the space today, yeah. Do you feel like as a genre, rap has moved forward in the African context, or do you feel like Afrobeats has swallowed it completely? Yeah.
This is another good question. Back to back, another banger. Like Rema. Oh, no. That's a great question. I think rap has sort of been like in the same position. It's like the stepbrother that does all the housework, but constantly people are like, but you didn't do this, you didn't, you're not even like your brother, you're not even like, you know, when I was coming into the genre, Rugged Man was already like top of the game. Idris Abdul Karim and Mode 9. These are three legendary Nigerian artists. But the narrative around hip hop at the time was, it's the second, you know, second fiddle. Hip hop is not going to be great. During my time, MI, Nado C, Olamide, Fino, Da Green. It's like top artists after top artists. The narrative was the same. Rap is not, you know. If you look at the genre right now, Odumodu Black is literally the biggest artist from Nigeria via streams, right? And still the narrative persists, right? And I feel it's more about how hip hop is seen culturally in context of Nigeria, the Nigerian context, than its actual performance. Like, I don't think like rap is going to ever be the top genre in Nigeria. It's not our culture in that way, expressive. You know? But neither is anything else. Neither has High Life, neither has Fuji, neither has, you know, any other style, because that space for the mass enjoy pop, and pop is an amalgamation of everything. Who has contributed most to pop? If you look at the outfits, if you look at the slang, you look at the way music is broken down, you listen to the beats, you listen to it's hip hop. Hip hop has literally been the stepbrother or the step sibling that has done all the work. We gave you guys the phrases. You listen to anybody, they'll say, yo, before they start singing, you know, they do a verse, they rhyme. It's all hip hop as the substrate of pop music. But then we don't get the credit, even when we perform well. Yeah. But it serves us well. Hip hop is a little bit about that chip on your shoulder mentality. So I don't know what we'll do if people start being like, yeah, we love hip hop, we're the best genre. We would lose a little bit of that, you know, like us against the world. But look, rap has always done well in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And you can't, like, you're talking about a genre that's had MI, Olamide, Odumodu, Files, Ladipo, SDC, Jesse Jacks, Nado C, Ikechukwu. Like, it's 30, 40 strong alumni of like people that have done really great in the genre. And for some reason, we just don't get that recognition of being like, we are probably the strongest subculture in Nigeria, you know?
No, even piggybacking on that, I think even hip hop in general has always been an underdog story, right? So you can even argue that when you're now the top dog, what is the struggle that you're, because exactly. you were striving to become the top dog, but everybody loves the underdog story. Yeah. But when you then become the top dog, it's like, you know, where do we go from here? Yeah. You know, but let's pivot, right? We wanted to pivot to the music of business, right? A lot of labels struggle to last in Nigeria. We've seen, not to necessarily throw out names there, but we just saw Charlie Poppy's issue with his label. And there have been so many stories like that. Why do you feel like labels struggle to last in the Nigerian ecosystem?
This question I'm about to answer might get me in trouble at a global level. So I'm going to talk politically. So sometimes an industry is just organized in the wrong way from its start.
Foundationally.
And the entertainment industry, particularly music, is organized in a way that makes it difficult for the primary beneficiary or the key ingredient, which is the musician themselves, the writer and the performer, to extract just value. And that taints the rest of the transaction. So it's much like, in Nigeria, there'll be some of these laws that are just bad. The one that comes to my mind is like where like women couldn't own land. You know, it's just a bad, it makes no sense. Like there's so many reasons. And until that thing is changed, there's no way. You guys be like, oh man, our culture, men are, you know, but eventually you're going to be like, come on, like, what are you saying here? You know? And I think music publishing is on one end. Mechanical royalties are on another end. They're legislated through one body that's over here. And then the managers are on one side, the agents are on this other side. You know, this has been like, you go back to the 50s, black artists, especially black artists of the time, were complaining about this leading up to Prince. Prince changed his name to get out of a record deal, to Michael Jackson and his thing with Sony, to where we are today with Drake. You know, you think like Drake is Michael Jackson after Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
In terms of his size, the size of his catalog within the rest of the music business is so substantial. This is the second time we've seen it since Michael Jackson. And it's the same thing. It's about like, this is a hopelessly decentralized market. It's completely disintermediated in a way that allows bad actors to take advantage, and it just repeats itself. It just repeats itself. To me, this is where Africa presents the opportunity for the future, because where nothing has been built, the right thing can be built, you know, and where it's exceedingly difficult, you have to tiptoe around the major players in the West. You must follow through the channels in one way or the other. But here, what we've already seen on the finance side is like the financial infrastructure in the US made it difficult for things like like the fast transactions that we have on the fintech side to take root here. So we were transferring money instantly a long time before it was available in the US. I think there's so many other industries where the fact that there's nothing here creates that opportunity. And that's my hope. That's my hope, that companies like Task, companies like, you know, Maven and a lot of these entertainment bodies are not going to rest. They're going to continue to look at the model and be like, can we do something different? And I just want to add a little bit of trivia here as well. So there is this thing in the US, or it came from the US, called the 360 deal. And the 360 deal, the idea of the 360 deal is that, okay, historically, if I'm a record label, I only make money when you sell the CD. So I'm signing a deal so that I can sell a CD or a vinyl or whatever. But if you go do shows, whatever, that's none of my business. Now, when vinyls and CDs were no longer making money and music was available for free, thank you, Napstar, at that time, the labels were like, oh, we can't make any money. So what we're going to do, we're going to sign a contract that gives us access to everything an artist can earn, 360 of an artist brand. And this was, in fact, if you go on social media, if you go on Wikipedia, there's like, oh, the person that invented it was this person in, that is in Niger, because there was no money for CD. Yes, we started with Alaba. So now 360 deal, now we start with, but we don't just name them, you understand? So the point is, we are by nature innovative because our challenges are stronger, you know, and we just need to pay attention to that. That if you ask a normal Niger person, solve this problem, he's probably going to find a shortcut. And that's innovation, right? And in the music business, thinking that way and acting that way and executing that way will probably give us a just share over 10, 20 years of actually what Africa's contribution to the creative industry should be, you know?
I wanted to even dive deeper with that. So one of the labels, or I don't know if it's a record company, it's Empire, right? I think the other day on Instagram, they were saying Ghazi, I don't know if he invented this model, but he definitely promoted this straight up, hey, 80-20, simple, understood from the get-go. Yeah. I think something I've observed with being in the entertainment space is there's a lot of scarcity when it comes to a lot of deals, right? What do you think about that model, especially from Empire, but just in general, where an artist knows, okay, if I'm working with these people, it's just a straight up 80% comes to me, 20% goes to the label, that's it.
Yeah. Okay, first of all, shout out to Gazi. Mm. Shout out to Empire. They are really... Gazi is like... He's an inspirational figure in the industry because he's truly innovated, you know, and he was, I think, at the forefront. I may be getting my history wrong, but at the forefront of allowing independent artists even distribute in the States.
Yeah.
And without him, before then, distribution was something only the majors could do. And I think Empire, I may be wrong again, but I think Empire was one of those first companies that created the distribution model, direct to distribution model, and fought for it and are now, you know, earning off of those, off of that initial work that they've done. And you're right, like now the model is distribution for most companies. It's like, okay, you own the music, we will sell it for you and we'll share the proceeds and we will take 20% over the life of when we're monetizing it. You'd get 80%, but the labels will give you $1 million up front. Distributors will give you $70,000, you know, something like that. To me, I think the real change in the model is allowing the fan that enjoys the music and the artist that produces the music, allowing them to decide what the best price is. Now, what I've said is oversimplified, right? Because today, the streaming platforms decide what that price is. I can't go to Spotify and say, charge $3 for my own album. You know, my fans will pay for that. It's set. The price is set. And it's not just set by the market, it's set by an algorithm too as well, which is incentivized to have more players, which reduces the price. You know, if you think about it, the more artists there are, which is what the algorithm wants, the more people participating, the less there is to share, you know. And then that allows the big labels to truly also own that pot. Because if I have a lot of actors, everybody's listening to music in one place, if I can then push my own product in front of the most people, then I win. So it's made the big labels stronger. It's made, I think the start like 90% of the artists on Spotify don't make any money. Something, it's maybe even more, 95 or something like that. It's crazy. So eventually, I think the model is like, I have 100 fans. I live downstairs from Echi Achika, you know, and Echi Achika love my music. And once a year, they invite me to come and perform. And to them, it's valued at $1 million. And then they buy my album. I make a vinyl for them, a t-shirt for them, and they buy it at $100,000, you know. And that is the money I need to keep going. If I scale that to 40, 50 people, you know, that's enough in my own ecosystem, in my own sound. If I become global, great. Now, the tools that will allow this model, you know, be functional, I think are being built right now. We're figuring it out from a completely disorganized market, you know, now to a more organized market.
I think that's even a good point. I don't know if you saw the Jay-Z announcement where he said he invested in a South Korean company.
Oh, wow.
That allows, or partnered with a South Korean company that allows fans to invest in the music of the favorite artist. So I guess they can either invest beforehand or just invest, period. But then fans will now get a say to say, hey, we want to invest in this artist and push their music. So I think it speaks to how you're saying, like, that's potentially the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think that Web3 just opens up the world, what's possible there. We're going to see who the winners are going to be on the other end of that.
And I want to go deeper into this, how the artist can actually own the relationship, right? Because many, many long time ago, I started a music company called Decoded, right? And it was focused on lyrics. And the reason why I stopped was because when I started working with the artists, I realized they don't even own the lyric itself. Like there was no IP law at the time. So anybody could lift the lyrics from my website and say they're the ones who created it, right?
Wow.
Yeah, and I don't know if to this day that has even been solved. So I'm curious, you know, I know in America, there's a very strict law about, you know, words, about, you know, even the melody around the word. Like, are those things protected for the artists, right?
That's
and can they make money?
That's a good point because so the rights on music are generally as we have it today, they're divided into two parts. So when I write a song, the idea, which is basically in the lyrics and the melody. Yeah, that's publishing. That means that the person didn't have a publisher because there is a right for that. So if I write lyrics, I do own the publishing right to the lyrics and the melody. So it's split 50-50. 50% goes to the music. So if I wrote like Happy Birthday, that melody, if anyone wants to use it, they owe the creator of that melody some money. And if I also want to use the lyrics, Happy Birthday to you, I also owe the writer some money. However, we can't sell the lyrics and the melody. So we create a version of a song that we call a master. That's what the label buys. The label buys, like, this is a recorded copy. We're going to call it the master copy. This is now the official version of this song for history. The label now puts their rights up around that. So you're right. That right doesn't necessarily transfer to what you're talking about, publishing. To me, in this space, what I would say to you is that most artists don't have access to the information. And it's much like becoming an engineer, like a tech engineer. And they're like, well, okay, for you to do coding, you need a typewriter. But the typewriter, the keypad is connected to an MS-DOS system. But then your screen is connected to Windows and your CPU is going to be connected to Linux or something else, you know? And you just decentralize everything so that it creates so many barriers that maybe somebody's just going to be like, I'm just going to be good at typing. Someone's going to let me know. I'm just going to type and that's all. And that's sort of the way our space is today. It's like everything is in so many different parts that you find a lot of young artists who, at the point they do their first deal, they're looking for money. They have the talent, they have the passion, but then they get to this point where they're like, okay, I need money. I need to make some money from this. So they're looking for money. They go and meet somebody, the person, I'll give you money. The person is going to sign the rights that are visible to them. So like my first record deal was just about mechanicals. It's like, I need to sell the CD. I need to get the rights for the CD, right? But then maybe they'll just throw like a publishing clause. You know, we're going to own your publishing 10 years. Now, what's the artist looking at? How much am I getting? 10 million naira. The guy is looking at, I need to sell the CD. In that agreement, now we may have made blunders or committed to many other aspects of what we're doing. BMI, ASCAP, you know, all these other performance, like neighboring rights. There's so many other rights that are out there that go into what this song could be and do. And you're right, a lot of times the artist doesn't even have knowledge or access to that. So they don't know how to think about that. And you actually make a great point. There should be a way to, I don't know if there are apps that actually monetize the written, you know, because a song without melody is a poem. So, yeah. You've given me some thinking to do. We'll talk about it offline.
Yeah. So I want to now go into, because I feel like there's two parts of you, right? Yeah. So there's MI, the artist, and then there's Jude, the executive,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. How do you balance the two? Have you figured out the balance at all?
No. In fact, okay. I've been talking to investors recently. The funniest question I get is someone will look at me and be like, so how are you surviving now?
Wow.
To me, the question interprets to me as, I know you used to be an artist and make money from being an artist. Is this what this is about? Are you trying to raise money because music is not really working out anymore? But I would say that it's really impacted my career, the fact that I've been so focused on entrepreneurship, but in a way that I'm proud of, in a way that I'm building up to something. You know, my thesis in life is largely that if you're an artist, the brain that created music is just a creator. It can create. It can look at problems and solve problems. And we sort of get relegated. We're sort of like, when you show up and you're like, I'm an artist, people sort of give you that response like, oh, okay, how are you doing? How's the music business? Yeah, you know, that kind of like, oh, you guys are. But the CPU that's up there is literally like taking words, matching them to melody, matching them to data points that you've had from performing and seeing other people, matching them to what an experience is going to be like, matching them to how you're going to dress, how you're going to step on stage. It really is a complex algorithm that's going on in your head. And that brain can do so much more. It can give the world so much more. But it's very difficult because music is full-time. I think I'm blessed that I had gotten to a certain point in my career before I started really doing things like Task and I was running Chocolate City. And it's not easy. I mean, my wife helps me, you know, I'm a little bit more balanced now in my life. I have a great team as well. And for me, I'm able to integrate what I'm doing musically with what I'm working on, but it's definitely something I want to share with the world when I get to a later point in my career. It's like, look, you can do more. This is how I was able to balance both, you know. But like most execs, I'm sure most execs, if you ask them, they're going to be like, we're not really balancing, we're just managing, you know, we're figuring it out. I don't think there's a perfect balance, you know.
And I want to go deeper when, you know, the investor says like, okay, is this music thing not working out for you anymore? Is this why you're raising?
Yeah.
Was there ever a moment in time when you were done with music? You're like, I'm not interested in it. And ooh, what pulled you back into creating the music again?
That's a very, very good question. Very good question. I had that moment. I was by the door. I left Chocolate City. So I'm very glad today that I left my role as CEO of Chocolate City. But at the moment when it was happening, when all these pieces were coming together, the world was conniving to set me on a new path. I had like a couple of weeks where I stepped away and I was like, is this the world telling me, thank you, MI, you know? And I really had to ask myself, is there anything more for you to do? Is there anything more that you're going to add? Like, there are all these young rappers. They're going to keep the party going. You know, they're going to keep the young people. They're going to drop bars. Like, you've done enough. You're goated, you know, but there were two answers that came to me. Number one was like, I felt if I was a fan of MI when I was a young person and I'd watched the story go, would I feel like the story was completed? You know, and I was like, I think there's still more to go. And then the other thing which I spoke about, I was like, maybe for like the Gen Z audience, I don't have as much to offer as an Odumodu or a younger rapper. But that's not the complete world of music. There is a larger context, a globe that is discovering African music. And I was like, if in this next dispensation, knowing what I can do, knowing the music I make, as people are falling in love with music, if they also discovered MI's music, would it add to the story of who Nigerian artists are? And I was like, yeah, there's not many people that can do what you do. When it comes to crafting those albums and making really, like, I feel like Kendrick gets into a space where you look at a body of work and you're like, this is art. And I am Nigeria's representative for that. Do you know what I mean? So I was like, there's still some work to do. I'm still on that pathway. But it was a real moment for me where I had to ask myself, do you still want to do this? You know, because there's so much of being an artist that I don't enjoy, you know, so much of being an artist I don't enjoy. But yeah, I'm still going.
And speaking of that, right? So you are goated, right? And you're right. And so I'm curious, how do you do that transition from I'm a veteran, like, to I think what I really want to say is relevance, right? Yeah. It's like, I think there's new art, especially in Nigeria, every day there's a new artist, there's a new, someone hotter, younger, more fire. You know, how do you deal with that transition of like looking and saying like, oh, okay, I'm not in this set anymore. I'm in a different set. How have you been able to handle that?
You guys killing me with the question. You know, when I was about to, before I had my moment of blowing up, I come from the same secondary school as one of the guys on Style Plus. And Style Plus were top of the world. And so I was talking to my Oga Audu at the time. And he might not even remember saying this. And I was trying to get a collab. This is 2006. I remember there was a census in Nigeria. And I was, I may be wrong about that too. There was something, Sha, and we were locked down. And I was in Lagos at the time. And I was in the same hotel with Style Plus. And I remember I just wanted them to listen to my song. And I had this song I wanted them to feature on. I was like, this is going to make me, you know. And I was talking to Audio about it. And Audio was unimpressed. And I was like, why? He said, they're on the way out. You're on the way in. Now, as a young artist, that blew my mind. Here are these guys on the top. Are you telling me that I'm in a privileged situation compared to them? That statement has been with me my whole career. And what I've realized is that your ego may be having a different conversation with you. It's not even about artists, though. This is just human. Your ego may be having a different conversation with you. To me, that is what growing up is. Growing up is to be able to talk back to your ego and inform it, you know, and be like, okay, I see how you're seeing it, but there's another different way to see it. So there is this moment when you're young, when everything just seems to come together and your, you know, energy and everything, and walking away from that moment, you know, I feel the real question is like, who am I now? And many artists don't make it all the way to the other end. They stay in that place. And again, this to me is not even about music. It's an analogy for life. Like, I just see so many like of my OGs that were, you know, they'll tell you, oh, when I was, you know, I lost my job and they cheated me. And that's the reason I've not gone anywhere in life, you know, and I'm stuck there. I'm stuck in this moment when I was like mid 40s or late 30s or something. And it's become the defining thing of my life. And it's a lot easier for me now. It wasn't always as easy when I started, but to just be like, look, that's a day in your life. It's a moment in your life, and your life is going to continue to have many more great things as you go along. And you have to keep living your life. You know, you have to keep moving forward. I find, like when I turned 40, I find it was like I unlocked a new level. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, there's actually another level. And to me, that's the cycle of life. Something is born to die, to be born, reborn, to die, to be reborn, to die, to be reborn, to die. But I will say that have some empathy for your artists or your creative out there, because, you know, even at a human level, we can all feel what it's like when you know you disappointed someone, or when, you know, you're about to do something and people around you are not going to like it. You know, it takes a degree of strength, of like personal fortitude, to be able to say, I'm going to make this decision and move past what people's impression of me is. An artist has millions of impressions of people's expectations amplified onto them, and they're connected to it. They feel it. They can feel when they do a post that 40 million people were like, what the? They can actually feel it. And that weight over a life sometimes frays them mentally. It locks them into prisons where they are like afraid to show up as someone else. If I was a big star and I drove big cars, and now the math is not mathing anymore, you know, can I come out and drive a smaller car and go around? Can I go to a show where I had all the noise coming in, you know, and now be like the silent OG that walks in and everybody's just, you know, I was at a show the other day with Joe Boy in Lagos, and I got there with my team, my task team. So everybody's working, my logistics guy, the person playing sound, my content people, there are four of us. In fact, we even slept. I woke up, I think the show was at 1 o'clock. So we slept at like 10 and woke up like 12:30 and like got ready to go for the show. So it was like a working man. And then Joe Boy walks in with like crowd, management, beeps, blah, blah, blah. And I was sitting there and I remember being the young guy, seeing the OG and being like, yeah, this is nice. you know what I mean? Seeing the OG and being like, oh, wow, used to be this, but now. And the funny thing is that because I am so full of purpose now, I looked at it completely ironically, because I didn't want to be like, I know what the other life is, which is like, you guys have been hanging out since 7 p.m. When I don't hang out, I don't go one place, you don't pay for everything, you know what I mean? You could not pay me to do that right now. Yeah. My time is so valuable. Like, yeah. The purpose of what I'm working on is like, you know, so I sort of went into a long-winded answer. I think that people that are watching will take pieces of it. But to me, it's about saying, like, you're right, there's something very human about getting to a point where people appreciate you and they give you so much accolades and then watching that fade. But that is an inevitable part of being as an artist. It's something you cannot avoid. You know, Jay-Z has a line where he says, to be Bobby then, you gotta be Bobby now. The two go together. The two are go hand in hand. And I think accepting that and living through it is where the beauty is.
Yeah. Drake and Kendrick. Ooh. And your thoughts on it. And the reason for that is I had done shows and concerts where I did a tour of different Afrobeats artists. And what you spoke about where you can literally tell when it's hard for the person to be like, oh, wait, they want to pay me this now. I was used to getting this.
Yeah.
Or the babes are like this now. I was used to seeing this. Yeah. And you can literally see it in real time in their head where they're like, they're still stuck on who they used to be.
Yeah.
And sometimes the people around them find it hard to be like, hey, but where we are now requires reinvention. So what people tend to do is they just let it be. Yeah. Like you can continue to stay in that illusion of who you used to be. The reason why I'm bringing it back to like Drake and Kendrick, what I got from Kendrick was somebody who consistently reinvents himself. He goes away, takes his music, comes back as this new person. And also there's suffering that he's been through, that he's been through the calls. With Drake though, the reason why I stopped listening to Drake was I wasn't seeing. I stopped listening to him like way back because what I realized with Drake's music was
that's crazy.
It was a theme that he kept on going back to, but I kept on saying to myself, but you're no longer that, like you're living life. Yeah. Like in real life, people get hurt. They might find love. They might go on travel. They do other things, but it's almost like your music formula now has become formulaic, right? Now, is it working? Is it selling? Is it great? Great. But when style comes up against substance, you see what looks like in real time. So what were your actual thoughts on the Drake and Kendrick? You know,
somebody give you trouble, man.
No, just say it as it is because people want to know.
Yeah.
People want to know what it is.
I have a very like nuanced answer.
Okay.
Nuanced.
Yes. Okay, nuanced.
So, okay, first of all, let me first of all say I'm a Drake fan and I'm a Kendrick fan.
Okay.
I probably consume more Drake music than Kendrick music.
Interesting.
Because I get more out of what Drake does as a creative, you know, and people can add whatever criticism. They can say it's multiple writers. They can say it's 40 and the producers he works with. But just from a music point of view, I feel like Kendrick and I are closer where there's less for me to learn, you know, from listening to Kendrick than there is from Drake, right? Yeah. So this is just a personal preference. And I will just say that. Okay. This is how I saw the beef. There are three things happening at the same time. So thing number one, Drake was the number one in the industry. And I want people to understand what this means. Drake's catalog, there's content out there that says this. I haven't seen the numbers myself, but basically what is being purported is that Drake's catalog is as large as the rest of streaming combined. Right. So this is how dominant of an artist he is. So when you have someone that's that dominant, you have to understand that there's going to be hatred for that person. Do you know why? Every contract, every conversation every other artist has, he's the elephant in the room. You know, over 15 years, all I can tell you that having been number one for a period of time, whether you know, the good talk say you do, and eventually your head. It's part of human behavior. That head gotta come off that shoulder. Do you know what I mean? We'll take you there to be number one. When you are now number one, number two, number three, number four, number five, number six, they're all looking at you like
the same sword.
And same sword, they knight you.
They're going, good night.
Good night you. Same. So first of all, I feel, regardless of context, that's thing number one that was happening. Thing number two that was happening was that in the middle of this process happening, Drake actually picked a fight with someone who actually had a removed reason for being upset with Drake. Everybody else, Metro Boomin, they were all upset with Drake. I think a lot of that came from just competitive jealousy. You know, at its core, it's like, why are you guys really upset with this guy? You can say, yeah, this babe, blah, blah. But at its core, it's just that we're tired. Like, I'm negotiating my new contract. You're the guy. I have my new album. They're telling me, do you have a song with Drake? When you have a song with Drake, we're going to get the thing. You know what I mean? It's like, it must be you. My last album didn't do as well because Drake wasn't on it. So my A&R is going to say, can we get another Drake single? You know, he's just going to be in everybody's head, you know, constantly. And when you have a clear number one, it's very, very difficult for that person not to, you know. But here you have Kendrick, who I don't think even cares about that stuff. I think Kendrick, really, as he's grown and gone through life, he's sort of been like, there's parts of this industry that I don't agree with. And Drake is a big part of that and representative of that. And when they went to war, I think Drake miscalculated because he saw Kendrick as one of the others and didn't realize Kendrick had a holy crusade. A holy crusade. You know what I mean? That he was on, that had nothing to do, and he was able to, you know. And then to be at the third layer, it's like what Eche just spoke about. Are we at the point where a sound has had enough time, you know, it's had enough time, like a way of thinking about music, a way of thinking about songs, it's just had enough time. So to me, those three things are all interacting at one point. I will just say that I think there's potential that Drake, this has allowed Drake to cement himself as the greatest. Eche?
I agree.
Eche, don't.
No, I agree.
And the reason, you know, I'm a J guy. So for me to even say that.
Oh, I thought you were going to say greatest of his generation.
Greatest. Let me tell you why. Okay.
Nah, let me tell you why. Too far.
Let me tell you why. Let me tell you why. I don't know. Because if he comes back and drops a classic album, if Drake just creates 13 hip-hop songs that focus on, like, just think about if he made like a Tupac kind, like, you know, all those Machiavelli, those, that type of project where he was just, he focused that his pen on what he's just been through, on betrayal, being alone, being isolated. Everybody in the world would listen to that album because now we watched him, you know, and what do we love? We love a comeback story. Humans love a comeback story. If Drake is able to come back, I think then it elevates him past everyone because with everything you want to say about him, no one has ever had, not just the music industry, tech boys. Everybody came and danced on your grave. And the danger here is that if there's one person that has that talent to make that album, it's Drake. Drake is the guy that knows how to put music together. He knows, like, if the first part of listening to Drake's music was about his story of becoming a rap star, now we've given him a second story. And he's the best storyteller there is, you know. So I think that opportunity is there. I feel like Kendrick wasn't in my top 10 before this moment, but I feel this has put Kendrick at the very least top three, you know. I don't think he can, I don't see how, like, objectively we can put Kendrick over Drake just because they were around at the same time. Yeah. And it's like Michael Jordan, like Drake was doing it every year. For 15 years, every year he worked with everyone. Like, it's, you can't deny what Drake has done. But the guy that was better than him the whole time is like LeBron, Steph. You know, you got to put them next to each other because you get four, I get four. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah, your own four has some, you know, Kendrick is there. So it was just great. It was great to see. And I know I think I was a little bit sympathetic to Drake just because I felt like there was some of that I'd been through in my own life where, at a certain point, no matter what I did, rap community in Nigeria were just like, boring, yawn. No, Mi, why did you do it this way? And I was like, what changed? And later I would just think, like, yeah, in the rap category, if you, no matter who you are as a rapper, if you're having a conversation, people are gonna be like, well, but Mi, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like, if you hear that for 2 years, you're gonna hate that guy. All I need to do is just pass you without saying hi the right way. One day you're gonna be like, yeah, see, I told you, and you know, but it was great, entertaining. Yeah. I loved it. Shout out to Kendrick. Shout out to Drake. You know what I mean? Work with the boy. You know what I mean? Come down to Africa, work with M.
But I do agree. If he does come back, probably I would never put anyone above Jay. So let's even just put it, but he's definitely comparable. But I think the difference between him and Jay in how he handled that is part of being wise and wisdom is really calculating the sort of enemy you have in front of you.
Yeah.
Jay would never let all his enemies enter one group chat.
Yeah.
They can be in different group chats,
yeah.
But in one group chat, that's where I'm like, this is where you miscalculated, because the whole world or your entire enemy list found a way to enter one group chat. And this is then what happened from there.
Like, think about the difference between Jay and Drake, right? So Jay-Z was the number one in hip hop, but he was still a way off from being the top in music. You know, Drake is the top in music, period. So even though he raps, like the hate that he had was like you're talking about the head of top DMG. Labels. Jay-Z used to rap about it, but we never saw it like this.
Yeah.
Like this was something different. This, the only time we've seen this is Sony versus Michael Jackson, where every conspiracy about what happened to Michael Jackson, including what? Accusations of pedophilia.
Yes. Yes.
Right? Including those same accusations. We saw that play with Michael Jackson. That's the only thing you can compare it to. And that's why, to me, if Drake comes back, like if Drake puts out a classic rap album, it's going to break every single record ever. And he can do it. That guy can do it. He's been playing, I think he's not been playing his moves right. You know, like I would say, Drizzy, if you're watching this, let me tell you what you need to do. Stay away for a while.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let everybody miss you. Let's miss you. Just stay away. Be quiet. Disappear. Have fun. Live your life. And then when you're ready to start writing, write an album that explains to everybody, you know, what you've been through. Nobody has experienced it. To be number one, to see all the deals from that aspect, to know everybody that turned against you, to know your own fault in itself. Write that part self. I slept with this guy's girlfriend. I should not have.
And go to therapy too.
Did I go to therapy? Then when you are done, come back and drop.
Fall in love.
You know what I mean? Come back and drop.
Have something else going on.
If I just call it Drake, do right and kill everything. Done. Do you know what I mean? Done. You know what I mean? And holler at me. I'm the best A&R in the business. You know?
Actually, speaking of hip hop, looking back, right? Do you feel you are appreciated enough for everything you've done for Nigerian hip hop? Do you feel like maybe there's even underappreciation for what you've done for the genre?
That's a good question. I'm very respected, you know. I want less now, honestly. I want me, Jude, I want less from people. I want less popularity, honestly. I enjoy like this sort of like lukewarm popularity I have now, you know. Like, because there are places, like when I touch down in Lagos, everywhere, am I everywhere, you know. I run every morning with a hat, you know, and I cut all my hair off recently, but still I'll be running people, am I a bugger? I'm like, you know, so when I'm other places where it's more difficult to be known, I enjoy that. I enjoy being an observer again, you know. I'm definitely respected by a lot of the rap artists and I'm very grateful for that, you know. The rest of it, I don't know. I don't feel the weight as much anymore. I don't feel the pinch in my shoe anymore. I am fully focused on what to do next. And I realize that, you know, I think in life it's like, okay, what is the next, you know, talked about completing the story. So that's my focus now. You know what I mean? If they love me then, you know what I mean? wait till I do this. You know what I mean? Then, you know, so, and to me, that's it. It's like, your focus audience changes and then try and be greater to that audience. And that audience gets smaller and smaller as you go along. One day it's maybe just you and your partner and your partner thinks this is the greatest person on earth. And we don't even care about everybody else. You know what I mean? It's just both of us. But for me, that audience has changed a little bit and I'm working on doing it again for this audience. But I'm very grateful for what I received in the past. I'm very grateful for all the opportunities. Life was so kind to me. Like, I put my family on. Like, I used to say right before I left Chocolate City that I'm the most successful artist in Nigeria. And I said that not because I had the most money, but because in the total picture of success, you know, I was part of a label and I became an owner. I was signed to a label and I became an owner. in that label, I put my blood family and people I started with till they became stars. We all became African stars. I was able to be top of a genre continentally, like in terms of continent conversation, like what more do I want? Like whatever you have is going to fade one day, but you have to know when you got enough. And I think from music, from rap, for that phase, I got enough, but there's still more to do. And I'm fully focused on that.
Yeah. Now we're going to get real personal. Okay.
This is what she likes.
I'll try my best.
So how has marriage changed you, not just as an artist, but as a man?
Oh man. You know, I don't even need to talk because you guys, our timeline is not far. So when I see, you know, before I got married, when you talk to a married person, there's like a knowing they have. And most of them don't even bother to explain to you. They're like, don't worry, you sweater, you know, because it truly is the most transformative thing. First of all, you have someone watching you. Now, what I didn't realize is that most of your life, you're actually not paying attention to yourself. You're actually thinking. So you actually don't know what you're doing. Do you know what I mean? When someone offends you, you stop thinking about yourself or watching yourself. You don't know what you're doing. So you might be angry and be like this, and you're tapping your foot. And that tapping of your foot is annoying people around you. But you're like, how could this person do this to me? That's what's on your dashboard. You know, it's crossing your mental dashboard. Now you have somebody who's watching you all the time and can give you feedback all the time. The feedback. You may get a feedback.
Like it, you may share this feedback.
Whether you like it,
my bro, you
any
get the feedback.
Any time of the day.
So I had to learn, and this grew me. I had to learn that it's all feedback. Regardless of the velocity or the organization of the feedback, it's just data. And inside that data, there's something for you. You know, there's something for you. And that grew me immensely. I started seeing myself. Like, I'll use an example, right? One day, me and Annie were having an argument. And she said something to me that I could tell she didn't mean it to offend me. But when I heard it, it was something to the effect of like, you're a slow learner, something like that. I can't remember the exact phrase. But in how she said it, I knew that she was not trying to offend me. So I had to, but when you hear something like that, you have to first gauge yourself, like, ancestors, how do we feel about this? And then I went and started to break down what she was trying to say. And what she was trying to say was that anytime we have a piece of information, I want to take time and sit down and be like, okay, explain it to me again. And I want to get all the pieces in my head. She can process quickly and start being like, do-do-do-do-do, and start going. As soon as I saw this, then I saw it all across my life. I was like, you're right. I am a slow learner. So now when I have a conversation with someone on something new, I know at the beginning, I'm going to need you to take 30 minutes. I'm going to ask you the question over and over again. I'm not even going to try. You know, sometimes you're like, I don't know, but can I say anything? I'm like, no, hello. I'm the person that's going to need you to repeat it again for me. And I just leaned completely into it. So now even my team, you'll see sometimes someone will say something to me, I'll stop, I'll close my eyes and fold my hands for like 2-3 minutes and just try and process what I've heard and be like, okay, do I understand it? Okay, what do I think? And that just helped me in business. It helped me in life. It helped me, you know, coming from this moment where in the moment when I heard it, I was like, how do I, as an African man, what do I say about this? You know, and that's been my experience. I use that example because I think it's very visceral. It's like something where if someone hears it, they're like, huh? But it actually ended up being transformative for me. I learned, you know, I had my opinions on the gender conversation. You know, I see it completely differently now in terms of what it means to be a man, you know. And I realized that there are boyish parts of my software that is only marriage, you know, because there are some boyish parts that seem like man-ish parts, you know?
Name them. What are these boyish parts?
Let me give an example of like when you're going into adolescence and you're going into like being assertive and being able to be like, no, that's not what I'm saying. And being able to show, without necessarily to get into aggression, but being able to show from how you speak or how you can guide a conversation or how you can control a conversation, being able to show that is very masculine. It feels like when you see it when boys play basketball or football, it's like, no foul, blah, 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 all this like testosterone. Now in marriage, you have need a new toolbox. Mm. That's heading you down a different path. You are driving to Badagry where you're trying to go to. You are speeding to Badagry. You're trying to go to Abuja. Different paths. And I feel then you learn that to be a man is different. To be a man is to be different. You may never even get to speak. You may be the last person to speak. You know, you may be quiet. My brother is like, this is an experience.
I'm like, keep talking, keep talking.
You may not even get a chance. Do you know something? Your chance maybe is to speak maybe in 3 months.
When it comes back.
And somebody, while everybody's confused and or frustrated, somebody has to be quiet for those 3 months and bear it.
Wisdom.
And wait.
Are you hearing?
Guys,
I'm not just saying. Okay.
So, but you go through that period and that, like lessons like that, like lessons like when you marry someone like my wife who can make her own money, you know, but what does that do to your role as a provider? You know, this historic thing that we've heard about. You know, finding what that means. Because I feel, and I mean, people may differ with me on this, but I feel like there's still a need. This is me as a man experiencing my partner in your partner that you need to fulfill. Even if it's not that I paid for, you know, there's something there that being a man calls on you to provide, you know. And I will say that, you know, you guys should be kind to us, men. Chica, have mercy. Have mercy on us.
Are you hearing?
Have mercy on us. Do you know what I mean?
Kick in.
Because, first of all, I think... Oh, man. I can't go overboard here. Let me not say...
No, but this is... Yeah. I think take time to say this because this is very important. I think a lot of men need to hear this, so...
Yeah. Yeah, I would just say that it's not simple what it means to be a man now.
Yeah.
It's not simple. However, if you're not a man, society will discard you. Like if you go around Lagos, you're going to see young men that are completely discarded on the side of the road. Maybe in a day, nobody says hi to them. In a day, it can go a month, nobody checks on them. That's what it means to be an unproductive man, you know, in a world that's rapidly changing. Like the punishment for being what is deemed by society as unproductive or unmanly is so visceral, you know, and it's not clear to us what to do. Do you know what I mean? We're not even as educated. I feel like there's a generation of men whose their fathers were in the office or they were traveling or they were doing business trips and their son went weeks, months without getting guidance. This is how to wake up and do this. When you're 40 years old, this is going to happen to you. This is how to react. This is how to feel. You know, instruction, guidance, so that when you're in that time in your life, you have something to hold on to. Most of the men I know are literally trying to answer the question as they come to it.
Yeah.
Trying to answer the question as they come to it. And even when they go back to their fathers, the truth about it is that it's a lot of emptiness there. They don't have the answers. You know, they don't have the answers. So I just say, have mercy. Have mercy. Our amazing African women, our beautiful African sisters, have mercy on us, you know. have grace for us as we grow and learn.
The one I wanted to tap back into was when you said,
okay. I can't take this. I'm not here for
No, you're gonna help us.
Chika is my person. She's always right.
Chika. But there's just this one thing that you said I want her to really tap into next time we have a conversation.
Yeah.
You said, and he said something to you.
Yeah.
You had the ability to move with, oh, did she mean it this way? Yeah. You took time to process what did she really mean,
yeah,
and then reflected back.
Yeah.
Some people, though, when you do the same thing to them, let's say you were any, and then any is you. When you're doing it to them, they will now focus on your tone, the tenor,
facts,
the bass, and remove the substance that you were really trying to speak to, so that the whole conversation will shift.
Do you know why, my brother? Because you're a man. So she, it's almost as if I'm emotional, it's different. But if you're emotional, it has to be different. Do you know what I mean?
It's true.
And that's the uncomfortable. That's what I mean about, like, because in the boy arena, you can't punk me. You cannot punk me. This is where I'm raised on that. You can't punk me. You know, and I feel like a lot of times in my relationship in the past, I deal with that emotion of like, yo, am I being punked? Because that grates on our masculinity. It's like scratching on the book. It's like, am I being punked? Am I being disrespected? Am I, you know? And it's tough. But what I find is that from their perspective, they're like, but you're a man. So you're meant to be calm. If I hold that thoughts, hold that pain till I figure it out by myself. Swallow it till I figure it out by myself and I solve the problem. Do you know what I'm saying? You just be here and watch the door. Do you know what I mean? Watch the door.
Facts.
And I feel like, that's just what I mean. It's like the tools, like now that we're in life, we're figuring out that, man, life is actually calling on us to do things that are, you know, in some level, just unfair. Like, it's just unfair. The older both my wife and I get, the more I can see that our bodies are not the same. Like, if she does a full week of work, you know? Oh, let me even simplify.
I know. I'm a woman, so I know.
Most of my friends that are around the same age,
yeah,
the women are really reassessing around exhaustion. You know, most of the men that are my age are all ramping up. They're all like, oh, I just figured it out now. I'm about to go grind my next thing. And to me, that's just an indicator of like, there's actually a very clear difference between how these two genders experience the world, right? And I feel like that's just unfair. You know why? Because men die earlier than women. It's like you end up working, you end up becoming this thing that every society wants. A gentleman that doesn't talk about his emotions, that can be patient, that can make money and provide, and now your heart gives out because of what that costs you.
The trade-offs.
Everybody will just come to trade-offs. Everybody will just come and say, what a great man.
And your wife has 30 years to live.
Bro, you know what I'm saying? And so it's a bit of unfair. It's the same thing. Like, if you don't want to be a woman, my brother, la pate kalu. What they are going through is different, on a different level. And I feel it's about having grace for both sides and having the empathy to see, like, you're having a completely unfair experience the same way I am, you know, and I'm going to be with you through it, you know. That's sort of the key.
I love it. Thank you, you know, for breaking it down. And actually, speaking of age, right? Because I think this is really important, because I think you can speak from a different perspective. You're now in your 40s, yeah, right? So who is am I now, right? And what does that look like? Like, what does the next chapter of your life look like?
Yeah. Look, I think I'm looking forward to becoming an elder, you know, in society. Like, now when I look around Nigeria, I'm like, okay, this is our own time. Like, in 20 years, in 30 years, everyone is going to come and look at us and they're going to be like, what did you do? This country, you know, or they're going to be like, wow, our founding, the founding generation, you know, and I'm just focused on that. I did a cipher last year where I said, nowadays I'm working so J-Town can reach Miami and Taraba reach Kigali. We go get there gradually. And that to me is my mission. It's like, we have such a beautiful country. This country is beautiful for so many reasons. It's people. First of all, it's people that were stolen generations ago, you know, have excelled. It's people that just traveled recently have excelled over the last few generations. We have so much knowledge. We have all the natural resources. We've been through trauma, but we've emerged with rich culture, rich music, diversity. You know, Nigeria is truly a special, especially diverse place. Like the amount of diversity that's functioning together, you know, and we are the ones to tie it all together, you know. And I think we are the ones, like we are the ones. And I'm excited to play my role in that. I feel very, very like blessed. Like this kid from Jos, you know, got to come to Lagos. Like, first of all, I was born to parents that filled my mind with music and books and imagination. I was born at a time where I was able to do music, you know, around the church. And I got this opportunity right when Afrobeats was taking off to be part of that journey. And now it's a difficult time, but as the West and the rest of the world is letting us know, you better go back to your country, you, because it's real. You know what I mean? It's real. Like, we care about ourselves first. You know, I'm no longer 20 years old where I felt helpless or a teenager. Like, now I'm a 40-year-old man, you know, and now I can be like, okay, I can go to Abuja and talk to the person interested and be like, can I help? Or can I build something? Or can I throw my hat in the ring? And, you know, that's just how I see the world going forward. And I look around, like, I mean, no gassing these two people here, but I mean, everyone watching the podcast, everyone that's part of the Afropolitan family and everything that you guys are doing, we're privileged and blessed by the vision you guys carry, you guys' ability to execute, you guys' ability to, like, every time I see, you know, the day you guys announced the race, mm-hmm. I remember Annie and I were sitting and he was jumping this thing. And I was like, man, I was like, I had almost a moment of fear because I was like, what Eche and Chika are trying to achieve, like other people that are looking at it will not even understand, you know, to think about doing something like this and then to put yourself to doing it and to execute and to raise the money and to go out and to go through the ups and downs. Like, you know, we're truly privileged to be alive in a time when there are people like you guys doing these things. And that's why I believe it's us. We're the ones. We're the ones that are like against the odds. We're going to build beautiful things, you know, and I think that's so cool. It makes me feel so privileged to be part of that.
You have honored us, man. You have honored us. Come on, thank you. Thank
you. Small
promo. You know it's real.
You have honored us. But going back to even what we are building, right? Yeah. You've built Task to help artists. What's the biggest lesson you think young creatives can learn, especially about longevity?
Yeah.
Right? Because it's less about, let me blow.
Yeah.
How are you going to be here 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and even longer than that? And what does that reinvention even look like for them? And you can speak very clearly to that.
Yeah. That's a great question. Look, I pray, young artists, I pray you don't die, you know, in the early stages of your career. And if you don't, then you're going to live your life. You know, you're going to be an artist for a period, but you're going to be alive for your whole life, you know, and you need to prepare for your life more than you need to prepare for your career, you know. So there's a lot I could say, but one thing I would say is that for the artists out there, let me look into the camera. If you're watching this, if this snippet comes to you, I want you to know that, like, if you can write a song when before you couldn't write a song, it means that after your career, when the next thing comes and you're worried, am I going to be able to be successful? You've already answered the question because you were already successful before at something that you didn't know how to do before, you know? And to me, that's what our first love is for. Our first love is to teach us that we can do it so that we can keep doing. And I think that something about the journey of being an artist robs us of that. It's so brutal and so difficult, you know? I feel like artists are the only people that have the same experience that founders have, you know? Like when a founder comes out of a failed startup, you know, everybody in the community, as far as I've seen, they put their arms around them in a way, because every founder, especially the ones that have succeeded, they know like failure and success are
thin line,
a decimal point away. You know, it's one fax that didn't, it's one email, the server was down, internet was, you know, the president decided that I'm going to change the currency. Do you know what I mean? There's so many things. So when you come out of it, everybody else in that place looks at you with respect. And I think that's lost in the entertainment industry. We look down on people that are not that successful, but they have the experience to go on and do even greater things. And I have this phrase that we use at TASC, creatives will change Africa. You guys are the change agents for Africa. You guys have the experience of trying and failing, of building, of gathering consensus and an audience and building. And so don't give up on yourself, no matter what happens. No matter who else does, do not give up on yourself for the rest of your life. Always get up and keep going, because you know what it is to make beautiful things. And whatever you put your hands to become beautiful. So that's my little...
And when it's all said and done, how do you want people to remember MI?
That's a good question, man. Husband, friend, Nigerian, builder. I put the word industrialist on my Instagram last year or a year before. And I just like the word, because it seems like such a heavy word that, how can I say an industrialist? But we're building the industry. You know, I saw something you posted the other day where you were like, I just had this meeting and I want to share with people about the right context between agencies and creators. And like, I've seen you lead in that space. I see what you're doing. You are going to build an industry, because you're going to go further. And so to me, that's maybe the thing I would love to do the most, is like continue to contribute to things that become industry, you know, just a good guy, you know, rap battle winner.
Zero losses.
some would say, yeah. But I think that's it. Footballer.
Dancer.
Footballer. By football, my dancer. I like that. Dancer, yeah. We can just keep going. Astronauts, you know. I don't know. But yeah, good guy. That's it, yeah.
So last question I'm going to ask every single guest is, who do you want to see on this podcast? Like, and whose story do you feel needs to be told?
Wow, the pressure. Okay, let me think of both of you. And because I know you know, you guys know so many dope people. So this is actually... I might just pick people that are already in the community. Have you guys done Ian?
Obviously, yeah. We're gonna do him.
Okay. Do you guys know Dixon? Dixon and Software, CEO of Quora.
Yes, I know Dixon. Okay. Yeah.
Dixon is a good guy.
Hmm. Definitely.
His story to building Quora into
I heard
what
his story
right
at your
now,
place. Amazing.
Dog.
Yeah.
It's insane. And he also, I think, is quite transformative, because he's really been, he doesn't like talking about it, but he's really been like catalytic to other founders as well. A lot of other people in the fintech space. So, but he has a great story. He's a J-Town guy too as well. So I'd say Dixon and so far. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys, man. This was truly amazing.
Thank you.
My peoples.
Wow. Thank you. All right. Hey.